Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It takes the Small Business Administration 37 single-spaced pages to explain how big a company can be and still be small, how much money it can make, and how many workers it can have. President Obama took just under half an hour today to explain why small businesses are the future of this economy and why he wants to give them a whole lot of money. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build strong customer relationships with email marketing and online surveys. ConstantContact.com. And by Bank of America, 1 year into a 10-year, $1.5 trillion investment in low to moderate income communities.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, today the 8th of December, and it's great to have you here. Forget Walmart, forget General Electric, forget pretty much the rest of the Fortune 500, too. Small business is where it's at if you want to get the most bang for your economic stimulus buck. The president himself said so today.
Over the past 15 years, small businesses have created roughly 65% of all new jobs in America.
The real number from the Small Business Administration is 64%, but still close enough. The president went over to a Washington think tank to deliver his economic speech this morning. It wasn't quite a laundry list of what the White House wants to do to get small businesses hiring again, but it was pretty close. Capital gains, tax cuts for them, tax breaks if they hire new workers, help with loans, all of which is nice to have, I'm sure. But is it really what small business owners want or need? From the Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk at Oregon Public Broadcasting, Mitchell Hartman reports.
Some of the incentives the president proposed today, like lower-cost SBA loans, have already been in place as part of the stimulus plan. Molly Brogan of the National Small Business Association says the loans are working well, so funding them for one more year is a good idea. But a tax break for hiring new workers?
While it certainly doesn't hurt and it can help some small businesses, we have questions as to whether or not it really is going to cause people who otherwise wouldn't to hire that next new employee.
John Down of the University of Portland's Center for Entrepreneurship says unless your business is already doing well in this poor economy, the last thing you need is more workers on the payroll.
For most small businesses, it's more a problem of how can they generate more revenues and continue to downsize on the expense side.
Some small business advocates think temporarily tweaking the tax code to spur investment is flawed. Take the idea of a targeted one-year capital gains cut, say for selling company stock. Raymond Keating is chief economist with the Small Business and Entrepreneurship Council.
The economy really needs substantive, permanent, broad-based tax relief.
And companies need cash and credit to keep their businesses running, says Molly Brogan.
Being able to walk into a bank and get that loan that you need to hire that additional employee, a lot of small businesses just aren't able to do that.
And that, she says, is something this latest round of incentives won't do much to fix. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
About those loans Mitchell mentioned, let's recall that even before the word recession entered everyday use, what we had in this economy was a credit crisis, banks not lending. In the year and a half since Lehman Brothers collapsed, trillions of dollars have been poured into the financial system to get that credit flowing again. Marketplace's Amy Scott reports that hasn't exactly happened.
Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke spelled out the problem in a speech yesterday.
Despite the general improvement in financial conditions, credit remains tight for many borrowers, particularly bank-dependent borrowers such as households and small businesses.
The Fed says consumer lending shrank in October for the ninth month in a row. Loans to businesses fell more than 6% in the third quarter, according to the FDIC. Banks are still holding on to more than $100 billion in government funds. The money was meant to stabilize the banks and get them lending again. But Campbell Harvey of Duke University says the biggest beneficiaries have mostly been large corporations.
We are definitely still in a credit crunch, and that crunch is asymmetric. In that most of the pain that's being felt is with small and medium-sized businesses.
The banking industry says those businesses aren't asking for as much credit. Bob Seewert is with the American Bankers Association. He says lending is down partly because standards are tighter, but also because there's less demand.
When you have a recessionary economy, businesses are not expanding. They're not opening new locations. So, you know, when your business line is trending down, you don't need additional funds.
But many small businesses that want to grow say they're having problems getting the money they need. Julia Battellini is building a wine bar next to her retail shop in Richmond, Virginia. After a business loan fell through and she lost three of her investors, she ended up selling her home to pay for the construction.
The joke is I'm going to live at the wine bar anyway, so that's hopefully going to close January 22nd, and we'll be open first quarter.
And that means jobs for at least five more people. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
It wasn't all small business in the president's speech. He also said he wants to spend more on infrastructure to get the economy going, and he wants to invest in green technology. To that end, the Patent Office announced today it's going to put green patents at the front of the line, a very long line of waiting patent applications. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explains.
It takes a long time to get a patent approved by the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, sometimes more than 3 years. So inventors perk up when they get a chance to cut in line. The fast tracking applies only to inventors who've already filed their patent applications. They'll have to apply for special status, explaining how their inventions help the environment. The Patent Office is bracing for a green wave.
It's sort of like trying to fill a teacup with a fire hose. There's, I would guess, maybe many tens of thousands of applications.
That's Aaron McGushin, an inventor who teaches physics at Santa Monica College. The Patent Office will take only the first 3,000 inventors who apply for green status. McGushin says those slots will go fast, maybe to companies like GE with a lot of patent applications on file.
So imagine they have 500 applications pending right now. I would imagine that they would want to put all of them in this program in order to get their patent issued very quickly.
And in the rush, the meaning of what's green could be stretched. The applications have to fit into almost 80 categories, but they're pretty broad. Artie Rye is an administrator at the Patent Office.
Alternative energy production and all the mechanisms for alternative energy production one could think of, all the mechanisms for energy conservation one could think of.
Rye says patent examiners will sift through those first 3,000 applications. She's hoping they can shave months, if not years, off the patent review process. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
It didn't matter what kind of business you were in today, big or small, Wall Street did not care for it. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Fourteen years ago, a group of Native Americans sued the federal government. They said the Departments of Interior and Justice had mismanaged their lands and the money that's sitting in government trust funds. That suit was settled today. The government's going to pay $3.4 billion to a half million Native Americans who have claims on trust funds that were established more than a century ago. From Washington, Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports.
In 1887, the government divvied up tribal lands to individual Native Americans. But Indians preferred communal ownership, so the government leased the land for development and set up trust accounts for the individuals. Handed down over the generations, plots ended up with multiple family members as owners. In 1996, 300,000 Native Americans joined a class action lawsuit, claiming the government mismanaged the lands and the accounts. Today, Attorney General Eric Holder seemed relieved to have settled.
What began in 1996 has seen seven full trials constituting 192 trial days, has resulted in 22 published judicial decisions, and has been the subject of intense and sometimes difficult litigation.
Class action members will get $1,000 each, plus reimbursement for their individual accounts. Congress and the court must approve the settlement. Native Americans claim the government owes them over $45 billion. But today, Eloise Cobell, who brought the original lawsuit, said it's time to take the government's $3.4 billion offer.
We are compelled to settle now by the sobering realization that our class grows smaller each year as our elders die and are forever prevented from receiving their just compensation.
The government will also create a $60 million federal higher education scholarship for Native Americans and reform the way the government manages Indian trust accounts. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
If we've learned one thing over the past year and a half, it's that there are some lessons from history we should be aware of, economic history specifically. Nancy Kane is the editor of a new book called The Story of American Business from the pages of the New York Times. Nancy, it's good to have you with us.
Pleasure to be here.
This is what, a 300-and-something page book, 375, 400 pages? It almost seems not enough to capture the history of American business. How do you organize a topic like that?
I did it on a three-part stool, Kai, and I did it just based on my historical gut that comes with having looked at this stuff for so long. And those three legs are the corporation, the large company, the changing workplace, which where I really am talking about not only what people do for a living, but also consumption. And the third leg is technology. But the second really important piece of this book is that I wanted a book that you didn't have to read cover to cover in order to feel good about.
Well, I'll tell you, I don't know what this says about my attention span, but it was great to dip in and dip out of this book and just, you know, choose these articles and read them randomly. And you come across these little nuggets, like this article from the Times in 1940 that says, the nation goes on a 40-hour work week. I mean, when you think about something like that and where we are today, you know, it's an interesting concept.
I'm chuckling, I'm chortling, because I have such pleasure in that as well, Kai. So another one is, you know, the introduction of the iPod and this kind of quizzical tone to the reporters as he's writing about this, like, oh, this is kind of an interesting device. I wonder if this will go anywhere for Steve Jobs.
The best part of that article, actually, was the part where it said, the market for this device is not yet known. And you're like, oh, man, are you kidding me?
And then there's another one about cell phones may make us rude.
Right.
And this is like written, you know, I don't know, 16 years ago. So that the wonder of the first time is replete in this book.
And also the changes that we went through as a country. There's a whole swath of articles from the 1960s and where women are coming in and more minorities in the workplace. What was it that made you key on that and sort of bring that up?
Because I think of business as much a social institution as an economic institution. A big hunk of the book is about, you know, social issues. There's a wonderful article from the early 60s about the emerging black middle class, called the Negro middle class, by the way, in the parlance of the day, in Atlanta. And what a sea change that is in that city. You know, that wouldn't have been possible, again, without a variety of political but also a variety of business events. And so I wanted the book to feel like a book that really pays respect to the incredible reach of modern business.
So when we look back on this period, on 2008-2009, what lessons will we have learned? Will we have learned anything, do you think?
I think we'll have learned several things. One, that we are incredibly tightly connected. We really are a global village in a way we've never been. Second, I think we'll learn that we overlook history and its lessons at our own peril. And I think we're going to have to learn that Adam Smith's invisible hand of self-interest is really no longer a useful descriptive of the way that market capitalism in the 21st century works. We simply cannot pursue a marketplace that is motivated and fueled by individuals pursuing their isolated self-interest.
Nancy Kane is a professor at the Harvard Business School. She is also the editor of a new book called The Story of American Business from the pages of the New York Times. Nancy, thanks a lot.
Real pleasure.
Coming up,
I borrowed my parents' Polaroid camera and went to that address. And 45 minutes later, I had pictures of him up in the bucket trimming trees.
A deadbeat dad or just a guy trying to get by in the recession? But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials lost 104 points today, 1% to finish at 10,285. The NASDAQ gave back 16 points, 0.75%, closed at 2,172. The S&P 500 shed 11 points. That is 1%, ended things at 1,091. Two bellwether companies had disappointing news today, and that helped push the market down. 3M erased 1% based on weak earnings forecasts. McDonald's grimaced at its declining sales. Shares dropped 2.1% today. FedEx climbed 2.7% on some rosy earnings. For-profit education centers cheered on DeVry's skyrocketing enrollment, up 23% this fall. The school's stock bumped up 3.25%. ITT Education put on 1.1%. Career Education Corporation rose 1.7%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term goals at Vanguard.com. By Gather.com, the social network where people can make new friends who share their interests. People talking about today's news at news.gather.com. And by Bank of America, 1 year into a 10-year, $1.5 trillion investment in low to moderate income communities. Give you the business 24 hours a day. Just tap marketplace.org into your mobile phone for the latest financial news and reports from around the globe on how the economy is affecting our lives.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. President Obama is scheduled to depart for Oslo, where he will accept the Nobel Peace Prize. The Commerce Department releases its monthly report on wholesale trade. And a Senate Subcommittee on Economic Policy holds a hearing titled Weathering the Storm, Creating Jobs in the Recession. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. If you see Made in China on something you're buying or thinking about buying, one of two things probably happens. You don't think twice about it, or you do. And then you think of the recent scandals over tainted baby food and lead paint on kids' toys, and you go buy something else. Beijing knows that, so it's turned to a Madison Avenue PR firm to help rebrand its image. A 30-second ad running on CNN that shows Made in China labels on a bunch of products and then taglines underneath. Things like Made in China with American technology or Made in China with European styling. And then you hear this.
When it says Made in China, it really means Made in China, made with the world.
The Chinese Ministry of Commerce says the ad is designed to promote Chinese goods objectively. Jay Wong teaches strategic communications at USC. Professor, it's good to have you with us.
Thank you.
So first things first, do you think this ad's going to work?
Well, I don't think it will work because, in the advertising world, we always have a saying that half of the ad budget is wasted, but we don't know which half.
That's right.
And in this particular case, we are addressing a far more complex issue. There are multiple layers of the Made in China label, you know, all the way from it's a poor quality, cheap price, to more political issues of, job losses for American workers. Mm-hmm. So a 30-second spot is not going to be enough to address all of these issues.
Well, then why try it in the first place?
Well, it's still worth trying because, you know, the central argument made in this particular campaign is that we should think in light of made in China, but made with China. And I think it's a valid argument because if you look at the contemporary business process, it is true that the Made in label is kind of antiquated because we engage, business partners all over the world to make a product and to sell a product. So from that perspective, yes, it is an important message. It's important argument to make. On the other hand, it does not address some of the underlying issues that I just mentioned earlier.
Obviously, they are advertising to American audiences here, right? But let me turn that around a little bit and ask you if you think there is sort of a domestic Chinese audience for this as well, that the Chinese government is trying to convince the Chinese people that what they make there is worthwhile.
Certainly, there is an important domestic audience in mind, I think, for any of these Chinese international outreach programs these days, because, you know, all the scandals with this poor quality products from China, all the negative associations with Made in China, had been reported in China and in the last few years that there were lots of discontents with Chinese domestic consumers with Chinese-made products as well. So for the Chinese government, it is very important to shore up this image of China so that in return, the Chinese public will be more satisfied in many ways with what the government, how the government is handling China's image overseas.
So do you think this is going to work, this rebranding, if you will, of the Made in China image? Is it going to work domestically?
Well, it certainly puts pressure, I think, on the Chinese producers. And the pressure comes from the Chinese consumers because they have higher expectations, more demanding, and in return, the producers are more likely to be more responsible in their business practices.
So back to the bigger point then of how this ad might play in the American consumer's mind. If a 30-second ad isn't going to do it on a trillion-dollar economic relationship, what will?
Well, it takes a lot of conversations, discussions, and I haven't seen other components of this particular campaign because I just thought that this would be a good thought starter as opposed to just a standalone effort. So there needs to be a lot more conversation, discussions on these issues because the message is emphasizing collaboration and integration, which I believe better captures the business reality these days and the relationship between the U.S. and China.
Jay Wong, he's a professor of strategic communications at the Annenberg School of Communication and Journalism just down the street. Professor, thanks for coming in.
Well, thank you. My pleasure.
Families that are lucky enough to have two incomes are being challenged by this recession. For moms and dads raising kids on their own, though, it can be almost impossible. With unemployment nationwide at 10% higher in a lot of states, some divorced parents are falling behind on child support. But the economy is also being used as an excuse for those missed checks. From Nashville, Tennessee, private investigator and radio reporter Thomas H. Humphreys has more.
The first thing you notice in some cases is the overuse of catchphrases and derogatory titles that grab attention, like the alliterative deadbeat dad.
Mr. Crawley, step forward, please.
Judge Philip Smith's courtroom is full this afternoon. 62 child support cases, but no deadbeats.
Mr. Crawley, you made $18,000 in 2008, and now you're only making $7.25 an hour for 21 hours. Is that right?
Yeah.
Judge Smith says he's flooded with requests from mostly honest dads and moms. Folks just down on their luck, looking for a little help, a modification in their monthly support payment.
I've heard very viable petitions to modify. We've had some plant closings around Nashville. These folks have no control over that. You know, for the most part, they're going out looking for jobs, acting in good faith.
That's no comfort to attorneys like Rhonda Spurlock. Her desk is piled nearly 2 feet high with case files.
Our modification caseload has almost tripled.
She's a litigator for child support services in the Nashville area. Spurlock says child support collections are down nearly 7% in her district this year. She says no one is immune, not even folks in one of the nation's wealthiest counties.
In Williamson County, a lot of our requests for modifications have been from higher income obligors, people coming from presidents of banks, high-level executives.
People who were making 150, 200 grand. Not to mention those plant workers from nearby GM who've been laid off and simply cannot find work. The economy's impact on child support has been nothing short of devastating, and that allows a handful of people to play on the sympathy of the court. The economy's given them the perfect excuse to lean on. I asked Judge Smith how he can tell who's just working the system.
You never can be sure. The decisions that I make are based on the proof presented to me. Photographs, videotape, those things speak for themselves.
Now we're getting back to my territory, evidence. Nobody knows evidence better than Renee Waters, one of the best PIs I know. She got her start in this business by getting the goods on her very own deadbeat ex-husband. I catch up with her at Patterson House, local gin joint. The room is dark, tin ceiling, bookshelves, and a bartender you know by name.
You know what you'd like to have tonight?
Considering the night, James, I think I'm going to have a couple of dark and stormies.
Can you?
Waters' ex told the judge he couldn't pay because he was unemployed. but she knew he had a job.
I borrowed my parents' Polaroid camera and went to that address. And 45 minutes later, I had pictures of him up in the bucket, trimming trees.
With proof in hand, the judge in Waters' case sent the deadbeat to the big house for a few days of reflection.
And Judge Robinson asked me back up to the stand, and she told me that I had done something that most young mothers don't have the wherewithal to do. And when I left there, that pat on my back, I still have it. I left there knowing what I was going to do.
Waters decided then to devote her life to helping single parents. Like Tira Tidwell, she's trying to scrape by on a substitute teacher salary.
Every month, those same bills keep coming in, and every month, that child support check doesn't.
Tidwell's not sure which category her baby's dad falls into, deadbeat or just down on his luck. But in the end, it doesn't really matter. She's still got to feed her 15-month-old daughter.
I lay there at night, watch her sleep, and I think about it, you know, that it's my job to take care of you, and, you know, what would happen if I were to be sick or anything? It scares me to think about that.
The bottom line is, in this economy, everyone's scared. Judge Smith and Rhonda Spurlock both offer this advice to anyone who's in danger of falling behind on child support payments. File a petition to modify immediately, before you get behind, before handcuffs become your only option, because serving time doesn't feed anybody. From the files of Find Investigations, I'm Nashville private investigator Thomas H. Humphreys for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Meritas, a worldwide alliance of law firms helping business owners and in-house counsel find pre-qualified local legal counsel for over 19 years. Meritas.org. And by Putnam Investments, where a 529 plan can help meet your college savings goals. Details at Putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, wherein AT&T tries to make the best of a bad situation. Maybe you've heard the complaints about AT&T's spotty network service, dropped calls and data outages all over the place. In part, that's because of all the iPhones out there soaking up network space. So AT&T is grabbing the bull by the horns. The company has launched an iPhone app called Mark the Spot. You drop a call, you lose a connection, you use the app and mark the spot. No promises from the company of a new cell phone tower right away or anything, but, you know, at least the app is free for you. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media this Tuesday afternoon. Today, the Dow dropped 104 points. That is 1%. The NASDAQ down 16 points, 0.75%. The S&P 500 gave back 11 points. That is 1%. Thanks to Jennifer Collins and Doug Krisner on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. Coming up next time, former Vice President Al Gore on capping CO2 and a whole bunch of other ways to save the planet.
We're pretending now that it's perfectly okay to dump 90 million tons of this stuff into the thin shell of atmosphere around our planet every single day as if it's an open sewer. And it's not okay.
We'll talk about the goings-on in Copenhagen as well. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that and more tomorrow.
American Public Media.